Okay. I call the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, March 15th, 2022, and the time is 5:06 p.m. Please silence your cell phones. This is Chair Natasha Von Emhoff in the House Finance Room 519 in the Juneau Capitol, and we have the following members present here in Juneau. We have myself, Natasha Von Emhoff, Vice Chair Chris Tuck, Senator Bert Stedman, Senator Peter Michicki, Senator Laura Reinbold. We have Representative Neil Foster, Representative Ivy Sponholz, Representative Andy Josephson, Representative James Kaufman, and Representative Dan Ortiz. And I don't think I see anybody else out in the audience. Would any members online verify themselves? I don't see anybody online. Okay. So we do have a quorum needed to do business. While the alternates are not expected to vote today, I'm very glad that you're here, and please participate. Our only item on the agenda today is to discuss the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation investigation. Thank you, everyone, being here tonight. So I have a quick opening statement. We are holding this meeting today to discuss the March 1st letter from the Department of Law regarding this committee's investigation into the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Board's procedures surrounding the termination of former Executive Director Angela Rodell, and to discuss our next steps. To recap, this committee does have statutory authority and responsibility to look into matters of any state agency or department that contributes to the fiscal, economic, and social well-being of the state and its citizens. The fund now contributes nearly 65% towards total annual state revenue, so it clearly falls within that category. The committee's goal with this investigation is to ensure that the fund stays politically independent from both legislative and executive influence and political agendas. We have two gentlemen with us today from our outside counsel, Schwab, Williamson, and Wyatt. On the phone is lead attorney Howard Trickey, and in person is Chris Slotty. Thank you both. We have Megan Wallace, Director of Legislative Legal, and Emily Nauman, Deputy Director, is also here with us. Thank you. Based on the content of the Department of Law letter, it's important for today's discussion to be on the public record. If the questions and discussion veers into items that is more appropriate to talk about in an executive session, we may take an at ease just to discuss that possibility. So with that, I do invite Mr. Slotty and Ms. Wallace, please come to the table and please discuss with us the March 1st Department of Law letter emailed to the outside counsel, then your research and response to the Department of Law letter, and then to answer any committee member questions. If members could please hold their questions until after the initial review and the response to the Department of Law letter, I'd appreciate it, and then we'll open it up for questions as long as it takes. And I also see that we have Representative Stutes and Representative Bryce Edgman in the room as well. So when you're ready, please begin and state your names for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Christopher Slotty from Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt. We'll first address the March 1st Department of Law letter. In this letter that was sent to Howard Trickey and requested that we forward it along to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, the State Department of Law has essentially taken the position that this investigation by the committee is outside the scope of the committee's statutory authority, on the grounds that the committee's authority to conduct investigations or to oversee the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation is limited to the Permanent Fund Corporation's investment policies and investment practices. In our view, this is an overly narrow.
Yes.
If I may, can you recite the site, the statutes that you're referring to in our limiting liability? Because I think that you need to read a little bit more into it.
Sure. Yes, the state has cited to AS 2420.156 and 206 and 201, all of which they tried to argue limits the scope of this committee's authority or ability to investigate and make recommendations regarding policies and practices of the Permanent Fund Corporation to the investment practices of the Permanent Fund Corporation. In our view, the state is taking an extraordinarily narrow view of the statute. The statute specifically talks about one of the purposes of the LBA is to include monitoring and reporting on the performance of those agencies of the state that have investment policies, that have investment functions. But this committee's authority is not limited to the investment functions of those agencies. Rather, the statutes specifically talk to the LBA, one of the LBA's duties as providing for an annual post-audit, an annual operational and performance evaluation. It says that the LBA has the power to make recommendations to the legislature and to agencies of the state that perform lending and investment functions concerning the structure and operating practices of the agencies. And it states that one of the LBA's purpose is to recommend, where appropriate, changes to the policy, in the policy to the agencies, or changes in legislations to the legislature, and specifically also refers to the structure and operating practices of the agencies. The statute is intended to, in our view, confirm the this legislative committee's authority to oversee or provide oversight over Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation's practices, operations, including investment policies, but also including its non-investment operations. Because again, that is kind of certainly an important aspect of proper functioning of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. So the state Department of Law has taken the position that this committee does not have that authority, that this investigation is outside the scope. We view that it is clearly within the ambit of this legislative committee. Next, this Department of Law took the position that there was some type of substantive due process, potential violation of substantive due process, because Senator Von Imhoff disclosed that she had a friendship with Ms. Rodell, and that house somehow taints the actions of this committee. In our view, there is no basis in the law for this approach. The fact, primarily because, one, a mere friendship is not a conflict of interest that would invalidate this committee's authority, particularly given that this committee acted unanimously to approve the investigation. And then the final approach that they have taken is to argue that the committee violated the uniform rules of the legislature when it went into executive session to discuss the retention of an outside law firm and the initiation of the investigation, and that somehow invalidates this committee's authority. We believe that the law is clear that the legislature is the entity that should govern the actions of the committees in terms of violations of rules or not. Is kind of a general legal matter. It's not for outside parties such as the state executive agency to try to enforce the legislature's internal rules. And then more importantly, there was no violation of uniform rules. There was no objection to the executive session. And then the vote was taken in open session, and it was a unanimous vote.
Thank you. We do have Mr. Howard Trickey on the phone. Mr. Slotty, would you like to, I think you mentioned he was going to make a statement.
Yes, Howard Trickey is a partner at Schwab, Williamson & Wyatt. He is the lead counsel on this investigation. He was not able to be here in person, but he is, that is why I'm here in person, but he is available on phone, and he had a short statement to me.
Mr. Trickey, whenever you're ready.
Yes, Senator Von Imhoff, I'd like to just add that some of the arguments that the Department of Law makes in its letter objecting to our request to interview people are similar to the arguments that were made in a prior investigation the Alaska Supreme Court has weighed in on issues that are not directly on point here, but sufficiently close that I think, in addition to the statutory authority, the Alaska Supreme Court has recognized that the legislature does have the authority to conduct investigations to inform itself about whether it should adopt amendments to law or whether it should make recommendations to agencies to modify their policies and practices.
Thank you. Ms. Wallace, you were part of the discussion on this letter. Did you have anything to add?
For the record, Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director. I don't have any substantive comments that differ from Mr. Slotty's response to the Department of Law letter. I'm happy to answer any questions from a nonpartisan capacity, specific questions related to the investigation or what the investigation might look like going forward are more appropriate for Mr. Slotty, but as the as nonpartisan counsel to this committee, I'm happy to answer any questions, particularly with respect to any of the procedural claims that were raised. I would concur in Mr. Slotty's opinion that the committee's action that it previously took in approving or authorizing the investigation, from my in my opinion, do not are consistent with the uniform rules that have been adopted by this legislature. The minutes that are available on BASIS for the January 7th, 2022 Legislative Budget and Audit Committee provide details about the motions that were made and the lack of any objection to go into executive session, and also record the votes that were taken by committee members in authorizing the investigation. So from my procedural standpoint, the committee has their actions are consistent with our uniform rules and are not defective.
Thank you. So I do want to say that Representative George Rauscher is here, has joined us as well. So thank you for your presentation. All committee members, we've read the Department of Law letter and we've heard the response, and so now we're going to open up the questions. And my first hand I saw was Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair, for either, well, let's start with Mr. Schlotty and Mr. Trickey. In the letter of March 1st, the state refers to a proposal to hire an independent person, preferably a retired judge, to review the issues, et cetera. The state takes the position that our work must be grounded in law, both whether it's the uniform rules, Title 24, et cetera. Is their proposal, to the extent it's fully fleshed out, and I would submit it's not, is that grounded in any law that you know of?
No, the answer, Representative Josephson, is no. I think it was proposed by them, a compromise measure, frankly, to have someone someone else who they perceive maybe as being more impartial conduct the investigation. But most retired judges are not really set up to handle a matter like this, don't have the resources to do it, and it would be the wrong path forward if you want to develop the record thoroughly on what exactly happened here.
You follow up?
And Mr. Trickey, I think it's obvious enough that through the chair that there's nothing requiring us to negotiate about any arrangement relating to an investigation or review of the issues. I mean, the letter suggests we should have a discussion, and certainly courts like to have parties reach consensus where they can, but what they're proposing can be dismissed in the first instance, can it not?
Yes, it can.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sponholz.
Thank you, Chair. I want to discuss the issue of the Department of Law's position regarding the uniform rules violation. And this is a question, I believe, for Ms. Wallace. As I'm reading the uniform rules, which the legislature has been adhering to for decades and decades, and we look at all the time in the legislature, it looks to me that Rule 22 very clearly describes sort of the way that we approach open and executive sessions, and that executive sessions is defined in 22B 1, 2, and 3 may be undertaken when there's a discussion of, one, matters, and discussion of matters the immediate knowledge of which would affect the finances of a government, two, discussion of subjects that tend to prejudice the reputation and character of a person, and three, discussion of a matter that may by law be required to be confidential. Was there anything out of the ordinary about the January 17th, and I just want to correct the date, that was referenced earlier. It was my birthday, so I remember it keenly. Was there anything out of the ordinary about the way that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee approached executive session that day? And in your opinion, was it appropriate that we approach this matter in executive session?
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, in my opinion, there was nothing out of the ordinary from the manner in which the committee went into executive session. The letter from the Department of Law specifically states that, or contends that the chair, essentially law contends that the chair unilaterally decided that the committee would go into executive session, and states that no vote was taken to go into executive session. From a factual matter, I don't think that that's accurate. There was a motion from Representative, as is documented in the minutes to the meeting, from Representative Tuck to go into executive session. There was no objection from members of the committee to go into executive session. Absent any objection, that's very consistent with the legislature's practice and procedure to allow, without objection for the motion to stand and then to go into executive session to discuss those matters. And it's a matter for the committee to determine whether or not that the reasons for going into executive session are sufficient. So meaning if there were a member of the committee who felt that the issue was not appropriate to discuss in executive session and objected to going into executive session, that is something that could have been debated in committee and is always open for debate, but that debate or objection did not occur at that prior meeting.
So thank you, Ms. Wallace. Just on that line of thinking, when the vice chair makes a motion and we ask if there's any objection, and if there's no objection, then the motion passes unanimously. What would prohibit this committee, hypothetically, if so choose, to simply take a roll call, despite being no objection, despite being unanimous in its not protesting? We took a roll call anyway. What are your thoughts on that?
Madam Chair, in my opinion, there's no substantive difference in those two approaches. I would generally, if someone were asking me that question, I would say that's a policy decision. Certainly, it's always appropriate if the chair requests, anyone can request a roll call vote, and so a roll call vote is always appropriate if it's requested. But Mason's, from a procedural standpoint, both based on the Alaska legislature's past practice and procedure and within Mason's, if there's no objection, then no roll call vote is necessary.
Madam Chair?
Representative Tuck.
Specifically, Mason's rule number 62, seconds not required is the title of it. The origin of the requirement of seconds to motion is obscure, and while there were certain requirements for seconds in Parliament for a period of time, this requirement was discontinued more than a century ago. The effect of requiring a second to a motion is to require that no business can be presented except by two persons, on and on and on. But basically, we don't have to have a second. Going into section 157 in seconds to motions, parliamentary practice in American governmental bodies does not require seconds to motions, and in Parliament itself, where the practice of seconding motions originated, they have not been required for more than a century, repeating the same thing. So it's an old rule that when a motion was made, it was debated second. But there's a quote from, there's actually a quote in here from a guy named Tileson. I don't know who he is, but he's quoted in Mason's Manual that says, quote, "It would seem that nothing could be more nearly useless and unnecessary than for some unidentified voice from the midst of the assembly to boom over, I second it."
President Michiki.
So I think there may be some confusion just on the difference between a vote where no one objects, which is unanimous, and some of the requirements we have for legislation where a vote is required. Can you just talk about the difference between those two so it might clarify for the public as well how we differentiate between those two types of votes?
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Michiki. So from a procedural standpoint, main motions, like a bill, passage of a bill, an in committee. Well, when we speak to floor votes, for example, the main motions, passage of a bill, resolution, amendment, those are taken by roll call vote because they're main motions. Procedural motions are often agreed to by unanimous consent. And part of implementation of parliamentary rules or the legislature's rules is based on how they are historically implemented by the bodies that are using those rules. And the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee and Legislative Council, for example, are longstanding permanent interim committees of the legislature and have each developed their own policies or procedures in terms of the manner in which they authorize certain actions. And it's my understanding that it's a longstanding procedure of this committee that, for example, if there were a vote to go into executive session, if there's no objection, then roll call votes are not historically taken on those types of measures. And so when we talk about whether or not anything was out of the ordinary, in my opinion, it's not surprising that no roll call was taken because that is the historical practice that this committee uses.
So I think the important thing is, I think the important thing is that we have this letter in front of us. We're hearing what our council has responded. And then our next step is to talk about next steps. So we're going to continue to be measured. We're going to continue to be thoughtful. And we're going to continue to follow our procedures because, as council is telling us, they are correct. So that, I just wanted to add that to your statement. Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, I think I wonder if part of the confusion about the issue around a second might be a confusion between Robert's Rules of Order, which require a second, and Mason's and the uniform rules, which don't. And if we were to, repass legislation out of committee and adopt amendments all the time as standard practice in the legislature without objection. We do it routinely in committee and we are a body of traditions as well as rules and law. And if we were to, say, change that, all of a sudden statutes which had been adopted and passed for decades would be considered nullified. And so just to sort of put a finer point on that, I mean, I think that there's a reason that we have rules that govern us and traditions that govern us, and that is so that we can be sure that when we adopt them that they are in fact law. And I just want to illustrate that for the public, that this is we're not doing something that is out of order in any way. Robert's Rules is used by many nonprofit organizations, for example. I serve on the board of nonprofits and we use Robert's Rules, but the legislature uses Mason's Manual and the Uniform Rules, which is a separate and distinct set of rules and procedures which have governed the legislature's practice for decades on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Oh, Representative Josephson.
Madam Chair, do you mean broadly or on the subject of uniform rules and our executive session?
The floor is yours.
To Mr. Trickier or Mr. Schlotti, do you view this letter, particularly the second to the last page where the state writes, if not resolved, the issues and others have the potential to trigger extensive litigation, was this preemptive or was there an effort to engage the investigation with, for example, a subpoena deposition?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, we sent after we were retained by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, Howard Trickey sent a letter to Chris Pogue of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation requesting the opportunity to interview members of the Board of Trustees and several members of the personnel of Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Mr. Pogue responded and said that the Permanent Fund Corporation is being represented by the Department of Law in this matter and referred us to the Attorney General. We forwarded on our letter to the eventually obtained the name of the attorney with the Department of Law who was handling this matter. We sent the letter to him, and then this letter from them, after a slight delay, was a response to our letter. And so we view this as we asked for their to schedule, voluntarily schedule interviews, and this was the response that we received.
So this is actually a good segue, Mr. Slotty, if you would like to discuss the next steps with this committee beyond today.
Yes, so the first step is we will respond in writing to the Department of Law. We are going to make the points in a little more detail, but broadly speaking, that the LBA, Legislative Budget Audit Committee, is charged with reviewing and making recommendations regarding the structure and operating practices of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, which necessarily includes the process followed by the Board of Trustees in evaluating executive directors, and in this case, terminating Ms. Rodell as executive director. We will respond to their claim that the Budget and Audit Committee is engaging in some type of unfair and prejudicial investigation by pointing out that the Budget and Audit Committee has, as a whole, authorized this investigation and authorized the retention of Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt. We will make the point that our client is a Legislative Budget and an Audit Committee, which has directed us to conduct a fair, independent, objective, and unbiased investigation into the processes adopted and followed by the Board of Trustees in its evaluation of the Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and including the termination of Ms. Rodell's employment. We will make the point that there is no logical or legal basis to claim that an investigation that was approved by the committee as a whole is somehow legally invalid because one member of the Budget and Audit Committee was open and honest with the public and disclosed an unrelated personal connection with Ms. Rodell. And finally, we will respond that the Legislative and Budget Audit Committee both did not violate any of the uniform rules in regarding going into executive session, and that ultimately it is not the Department of Law's place to try to police the legislature or its committee's internal processes. In that letter, we will again invite the Board of Trustees and individual members of the employees of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation to voluntarily sit down for an interview. They could have their counsel present, and then we will state that if they, and give them an opportunity, if they respond and say that they will not do so, then we will proceed to subpoena those individuals who refuse to sit down for a voluntary interview. And then we will move forward with our investigation, gathering the facts and coming to an impartial and objective evidence-based report.
Thank you. So, after the letter is sent, the response letter, Mr. Slotty and his team will reach out to the folks on the list, which I'm going to hand out here in just a moment. And my thoughts is, if you've got nothing to hide, shouldn't be a problem. Just respond, give the interview, move on. But if people refuse, then we're going to pass out subpoenas. So in preparation for this contingency, and so this committee may remain at arm's length, I propose this committee vote on a motion today to provide our outside counsel the tools needed to move forward with their investigation. So my staff is going to hand out the interviewee list to the members now. So we're just going to take a quick at ease while that happens. Okay, we're going to start off with Craig Richards, Chair, Lucinda Mahoney, Vice Chair, Bill Moran, Trustee, Steve Rieger, Corey Feige, Ethan Schutt. Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Management, Valerie Mertz, CEO, Acting Executive Director, Marcus Frampton, Chief Investment Officer, Chad Brown, Human Resources, Pauline Swampson, Communications Manager. We also have on the Department of Revenue Legislative Liaison to Commissioner Mahoney, Genevieve Watusek. Also for documents requested but still outlying, Records Custodian for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation for the production of records to be determined by outside counsel, and Records Custodians for the executive agencies of the State of Alaska for the production of records to be determined by outside counsel. That's the list. We have all the Board of Trustees and primary executive APFC management.
Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Since we're making a record, I think we should be clear that it doesn't prejudice our right to subpoena other people at a later time, correct?
Thank you. This is not an exhaustive list. This is a list we're starting with now, correct?
Madam Chair.
President Machicki.
Thank you for that. And this is a question for legal counsel. Does the letter state that our desire is not to subpoena any of these individuals, that our initial approach is to simply interview to obtain information regarding this investigation? What would trigger a subpoena? And this is, I guess, a question for our legal counsel. Obviously, it's not a tool we want to use. We hope we don't have to use it.
President Machicki, through the chair, our initial letter, our first letter, also said that we wanted to interview these witnesses without having to resort to subpoenas. And our letter responding to the Department of Law will make that same statement. It would be much easier, much more efficient for all parties involved if we can schedule voluntary interviews at a time to be that is amenable to all parties. And it is only, in our view, if they refuse to do that, and either refuse to respond to a letter or decline to be interviewed at all, that we will have to move on to the next step of issuing a subpoena.
I have a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up?
Is the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation obliged to react to a subpoena in a way that requires their appearance, or do they have some other legal basis that would allow them to refuse being involved in that process?
President Machicki, through the chair, in our view, this committee does statutorily have the specific authority to issue subpoenas for depositions as provided in civil rules. That is specific statutory language. And so we do not view that the if we successfully serve the subpoenas on members of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, that we do not believe they have a legal basis to refuse to comply. Now, that is not to say, that is not to say comment on what they will actually do, but I think under the law, they do not have a basis to refuse to comply.
Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Chair Von Imhoff, and thank you for being here today. My question is the voluntary interviews, is this some sort of a deposition? Do they have to do anything under oath? And how does that differ between subpoenas? Where I'm going is, what if they withhold information? They don't answer the questions, or they give a dishonest response? I'm trying to the next level of how we approach this. Thank you.
So, Senator Reinhold, through the chair, a voluntary interview is not taken under oath. It is someone who appears voluntarily. It's an interview of an investigation, and we evaluate the credibility. We evaluate the statements. We compare it to the statements of other witnesses to evaluate the credibility of what they're saying. If we issue a subpoena, that is a subpoena for a deposition, that would be under oath, in our view. And so they would have to testify under a penalty of perjury correctly, truthfully. So in this specific situation, if someone voluntarily appeared for an interview and said, either made statements that we knew to be false, believed to be false, or refused to answer questions, we would then have to evaluate the next steps. Someone appearing voluntarily for an interview would not preclude a subsequent subpoena for a deposition.
Any further questions? Okay.
I have one here.
Okay. Representative Kaufman, followed by Senator Machicki.
Thank you. I guess question for the chair. I think we should put out a little bit more visibility about what this process will look like. So if we interview and should it escalate and we do subpoena, so what is the structure around that? Do we have clarity on that? I'm just curious about, where does the information go, et cetera? What's the venue and the system for all of that?
So we've hired a third-party custodian to handle all of that. So all the information, all the interviews, all the keeper of the data from the interviews will be with Mr. Slotty and his team. And then they will assemble the information and create a report and give it to this community committee all at once at some point in the future. So it's hands off from this committee, and we're turning everything over, as we have been the whole time, to Mr. Slotty and his team. Would you like Mr. Slotty to expand on that?
If he will or could, thank you.
Certainly, Representative Kaufman, through the chair. If we end up, you know, for both interviews, and if we do end up having a subpoena for a deposition, that would typically be held, you know, in some an office, either in our offices in Anchorage or here in Juneau at a separate, you know, separate office. It would be with the court reporter. We would answer questions, have a transcript, but we would retain that, and we would not be publicizing that in the context of, it would not be like a public hearing. It would be a private interview that we would then take the facts that we develop from that when we produce our report with our and kind of include the background material with that report. So this is, a subpoena would be for a private deposition, I would say. It's not for a committee hearing, for example, or for a public testimony.
Thank you.
President Machicki.
So this is on the subject of a strange paragraph in the letter that refers to the McCarthy hearings of the 50s, and I think it's worth asking. It points to Section 7 of due process, and the Constitution says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The right of all persons to be fair and just to fair and just treatment in the course of legislative and executive investigation shall not be infringed. Is there anything in all of your experience that points to something unfair and unjust in the relatively clear-cut process that we're following here? I don't know if you find the paragraph strange. I did. I wouldn't have included it in my letter if I were to write this letter. But can you just clarify for us your thoughts on whether or not the way we're proceeding is fair and just?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, the short answer to your question is no. I see nothing improper about the way this committee has approached. I certainly don't believe that any of the efforts that we've taken, which again have been completely independent from any member of this committee to conduct this investigation, have been inappropriate. We are conducting an investigation, and that necessarily requires us talking to people, and that's all we're asking to do. The Department of Law tries to make a lot, or at least raise the suggest that we made some type of threat to members of the Department of Law or members of the Permanent Fund Corporation to be terminated or have adverse employment action for failing to cooperate when nothing like that was happened. We simply cited in our letter the statute that says that members of the state, employees of the state, must cooperate with the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee in its investigations.
I'm okay. I think the purpose of the paragraph is to paint a picture that doesn't exist, and I would assume that all of your interviews will be respectful, and that there's nothing in this paragraph that is reflective of anything that's going to occur as we try to determine what happened in this case.
Senator Machicki, through the chair, absolutely. We are conducting a fair, independent, objective, and unbiased investigation into the policies and practices of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Board of Trustees, and nothing more.
Thank you. Okay, Vice Chair Tuck, are you ready for a motion?
Yes, Madam Speaker. Madam Chair. Hello, Madam Speaker. I move that under Alaska Statute 2420201A2, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee issue subpoenas to the following members as part of its investigation into the processes adopted and followed by the Board of Trustees of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation in its evaluation of the Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, including the Board of Trustees' termination of Angela Rodell as Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation by the Board of Trustees of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Those subpoenas would be issued to the trustees, Craig Richards, chair, Lucinda Mahoney, Bill Moran, Steve Rieger, Corey Feige, Ethan Schutt. Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Management, Valerie Mertz, Marcus Frampton, Chad Brown, and Paulin Swanson. And then Department of Revenue Legislative Liaison to the Commissioner Mahoney, Genevieve Wachetsik. Also for documents requested but still outlined, records custodian for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation for the production of records to be determined by outside counsel, records custodians for executive agencies of the state of Alaska for the production of records to be determined by outside counsel.
Is there any objection?
Brief at ease, Madam Chair.
Brief at ease. Okay, so we're going to go back on the record. So Vice Chair Tuck just stated a motion, and Peter Michicki, President Michicki, I think you have, I wouldn't say an objection, at least a comment at this time.
I do. I so we're all friends and neighbors in this business, and the motion that was stated said that we will be issuing subpoenas. My hope is that folks will work with us. Subpoenas may not be necessary, and my request was that the shall would be changed to a may. We're presenting an open offer that hopefully everyone will work together and cooperate on what we're all trying to do together here and understanding what happened with the corporation. And if the motion does the same, if we don't see that level of cooperation, then it still allows subpoenas to be issued.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just want to say I strongly agree with Senate President Michicki on that. I think one of the things we have to be aware of, we have to do no harm. And as I've been saying repeatedly, I think we came in a little strong on the first interview, and I think we just have to leave a little pressure relief valve, and therefore I really like that language. I think it's only fair, so I strongly support those comments. Thank you very much.
Madam Vice Chair.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. I mean, Madam Chair, I'm the Vice Chair. I just want to remind everybody that we did give the chair authority in a previous meeting. As a matter of formality, we thought that it would be proper to go ahead and name the names. And based on our attorney's testimony stating that we hope that we don't have to use the subpoena process, but to make sure that the subpoena process is there and granted, I would like to remove my original motion and restate a new motion, if I may, Madam Chair.
I think that sounds like the committee's consensus, I think, but can we just have Megan Wallace just chime in, if you don't mind, just on switching, adding the word may into the motion. Do you have any initial thoughts on that?
Madam Chair, the motion could be withdrawn and another motion made, or the motion could be amended, whatever the committee feels would be more clear for the public to understand.
Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, thank you. This question from Ms. Wallace. I just want to be really clear. If we change the motion from shall to may, are we then requiring secondary action, another action by this committee, in order to issue subpoenas, or are we still giving? We're still guaranteeing that the chair has the authority to issue the subpoena, or that our attorneys have the ability to issue the subpoenas on behalf of the committee at that point in time. I just want to be absolutely clear about what we're deciding at this moment. We know in the legislature, one word makes all the difference sometimes.
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, one thing that I think would help clarify the situation is that the motion that was made to authorize the subpoenas by the committee authorizes the issuance of those subpoenas. It takes a separate action to serve those subpoenas on the witnesses to compel their attendance. And so the action of authorizing the subpoenas does not bind the committee or the investigator to actually hand those over to the witnesses that you've listed, unless the investigator determines that that's necessary. And I certainly would yield to Mr. Slotty or Mr. Tricky if they have a different view of that.
No, I would agree with that.
So to be clear then, the motion that we're going to restate the motion does in fact allow a two-step process with the word may. We are signing subpoenas today. We may or may not serve them, or Mr. Slotty and his team and Mr. Tricky may or may not serve them depending on the response of the folks on this list. This committee does not have to reconvene, I'm confirming this with you, to meet again to give you permission to serve those subpoenas if necessary. The motion today covers that. Can you please confirm?
Through the chair, I would clarify that my statement was with respect to the original motion, which stated that the, and maybe Representative Tuck could restate or tell me the exact verbiage of the original motion, just to clarify what did it say, shall or will authorize?
It doesn't say either. It just says I moved that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee issue subpoenas. It doesn't say shall, doesn't say may, doesn't say will. It just says that the Legislative Audit Committee issue subpoenas to the following persons.
Madam Chair, the motion that was stated for the committee to issue subpoenas grants the explicit authorization from the committee to issue and serve subpoenas to the witnesses that you've identified. That language does not prevent or does not compel the investigators to immediately issue those subpoenas or to serve those subpoenas. I don't mean to mix up those terms, but the committee issuing those subpoenas or authorizing would be another word that you could use in your motion, is that the committee wants to take official action to authorize the use of subpoenas in the investigation, and authorization of subpoenas today does not compel that they will automatically be used unless necessary.
Thank you. President Michiki.
From my personal view, is the word may doesn't change that outcome. Do you agree with that? So we are providing the authorization, but they may or may not be issued.
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, can we take a brief at ease?
We're going to take a brief at ease. Thank you. So the conversation that we're having now is whether the motion is clear in its intent to provide the flexibility and option for the council to use the subpoenas or not and allow them to make that judgment call. Mr. Slotty, may you please comment on that?
Thank you, Chair. Our plan, and we will respond in writing to the Department of Law, we will ask them to make the individuals identified in the list that the committee is considering available for a voluntary interview. If those individuals decline to appear for a voluntary interview or refused or failed to respond, it is at that point that we would then serve the subpoenas on them to conduct the deposition.
Thank you. And we are creating this motion today to have those subpoenas passed by a motion and signed today to hand them over to you to use them at your discretion when you deem necessary. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is my understanding, yes.
Any further questions? President Micicchi.
Yeah, I will. I think we have, at this point we have to restate the original motion. I will support the original motion. I think everyone knows the reason I brought it up. I'm hoping this is a big step. This isn't something we do, right? This is a pretty serious issue in the view of the legislature. So I'm hoping that we don't get to that big step. I wanted to clarify that although we're supporting the availability of subpoenas, we are certainly hoping that we work together in cooperation. I just wanted that on the record. That was the reason I slowed us down for 10 minutes. I think we get to the same place. I just wanted it quite clear for the record that subpoenas are not a direction where we want to go. We hope things go much more positively and much more cooperatively. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. President Micicchi. Any further comments? Representative Spanholtz.
I think that it was made pretty clear earlier that that there's consensus in the opinion that voluntary participation is certainly the preferable route, but that in the event that voluntary participation isn't the choice that the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation representatives and Department of Revenue staff choose to go, that we have the subpoena authority in place so that we can ensure that the investigation takes place in a timely manner and we get the information we need in order to take appropriate action. Thank you.
Thank you. So I think what we'll have is Vice Chair Tuck repeat the motion in its entirety.
Madam Chair, I move that under Alaska Statutes 2420-201A2, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee issue subpoenas to the following persons as part of its investigation into the processes adopted and followed by the Board of Trustees of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation and its evaluation of the Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, including the Board of Trustees' termination of Angela Rodell as Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation by the Board of Trustees of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. We have the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Trustees, Craig Richards, Chair, Lucinda Mahoney, Bill Moran, Steve Rieger, Corey Feige, and Ethan Schutt. The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Management, Valerie Mertz, the CEO and Acting Executive Director, Marcus Frampton, the Chief Investment Officer, Chad Brown, Human Resources, Paula Swanson, the Communications Manager, and then the Department of Revenue Legislative Liaison to the Commissioner, to Commissioner Mahoney, Genevieve Wachiksek. Also for documents requested but still outlined, the records custodian for Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation for the production of records to be determined by outside counsel, records custodians for executive agencies of the Alaska State of Alaska for the production of records to be determined by outside counsel.
Is there any objection to this motion? Seeing and hearing none, this motion passes unanimously per our uniform rules. After the hearing, I would like to ask President Micicchi, Speaker Stutz, Vice Chair Chris Tuck to remain behind to sign the subpoenas. Is there any further business in front of the committee? Seeing none, I thank everyone for being here today. Thank you very much for flying to Juneau. Thank you, Megan and Emily, for being here. Thank you, members, and we are adjourned.